compromise and some controversy over the renaming of Hemming Park. Calls for school sports to start back up again as concerns over reopening continue to grow. And early voting now underway in next week's primary elections. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good morning and live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, all of the top stories of the week on our Friday roundtable. Give us a call. It's 549-2937 to join the conversation today. Then later, it is National Farmers Market Week. We will drop in on the oldest market in Florida, right here in town. But first, it's Friday, and here to discuss yet another busy week in the news, we welcome via Google Hangout, Ann Schindler of First Coast News. Hey, Ann. Oh, we'll have Ann in a moment.
Hey, Melissa, just working the mute button there. Sorry. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. We'll all make our way through this new COVID world as we socially distance but still connect everybody on the air. Thanks, Ann. Nate Monroe of the Florida Times Union also with us. Hi, Nate.
Hi, Melissa.
Mike Mendenhall, who writes for the Jax Daily Record. Mike, good morning.
Good morning to you, Melissa.
Good morning. And rounding out our foursome regular contributor, Fred Matthews. Hey, Fred.
Good morning, Melissa.
So good to have all four of you on the show. Lots to talk about this week. But before we get into the news, here is the latest on the COVID crisis by the numbers. Statewide, we have now topped 510,000 cases, a one-day increase of over 7,600. The death toll stands at 7,747 statewide, with 286 deaths in our area. Now, the other big news of the week locally involved the Black Lives Matter movement and the local iteration of that. As a move to rename Hemming Park after James Weldon Johnson ran into some opposition earlier this week. Johnson is the most brilliant and celebrated individual this town has ever produced. He composed, among many other accomplishments, the famous anthem, Lift Every Voice and Sing. That will be played at all upcoming NFL games in the next season, by the way. Now, local veterans groups made a late-breaking push to rechristen Hemming Park as Veterans Memorial Park instead of Johnson Park. And a compromise has been proposed to name the park after Johnson but have a Veterans Memorial Plaza. I spoke about all this earlier in the week with Earl Johnson Jr. of TakeItDown.org. That's a group working to remove all monuments to the Confederacy across America. And Johnson pointed out that we need to consider that Jacksonville now has a dubious distinction. Take a listen to this.
So I don't think there's anything wrong with taking a look at these naming honorariums. You know, Jacksonville continues, now that Richmond took down its Confederate Avenue, Jacksonville continues to be the world's foremost collection of monuments, honorariums, naming schools after the Confederacy.
That's according to Johnson Jr. He's the son of MLK's attorney and a leading civil rights figure in this community. According to Take It Down's calculations, Jacksonville has 11 Confederate honorariums in public places. In other words, they are taxpayer funded. Confederate Street, Confederate Park, a monument to the women of the Confederacy, although that's coming down. The Hemming Park statue, which came down but is still named after a Confederate figure. General Lee Road, Yellow Bluff, Confederate Point Road, and the public schools Jeb Stuart, Lee, Davis, and Jackson after Stonewall Jackson. Okay, so we're going to begin the hour with a closer look at this. And by the way, the Duval School Board is looking at renaming some more schools. We'll explain more about that in a moment. But give us a call at 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax, and our Facebook page is open. Fred Matthews, I'd like to start with you. Your thoughts on this late-breaking push to, instead of naming Hemming after Johnson, name it after veterans. Critics have said that veterans, and you are one, by the way, have already been honored quite a bit throughout the city. So what are your thoughts about this?
Well, it's an interesting compromise. As you said, I'm quite very much involved in the veterans community. I'm a veteran myself, of course, but it's an interesting twist on it. The thing about that has adding veterans the plaza inside the park to the name, is that it is basically a left-handed way of honoring all of the veterans, whether they are American military veterans or, quite frankly, whether they are Confederate veterans. It's a compromise to keep that side happy, a good push for veterans in general, as well as, of course, giving a nod to the African-American activists who have been pushing to get the park named all along. So many folks don't recognize that distinction. It's going to cause a bit of a problem for the city council. The mayor has already indicated he'll sign whatever they pass, but it's just a question of whether or not both of those names are going to make it through the vote next week, I guess.
That's right. This has yet to be finalized. Nate Monroe, as you wrote in this week's Times Union, there is a site for a Lift Every Voice and Sing park that is in the La Villa area of downtown, the site of Johnson's birthplace. For 5 years, though, that park has yet to be built. Johnson, which you correctly note is really the most luminous individual Jacksonville has ever produced, has yet to have a park named after him.
Yeah, I mean, and I think Lift Every Voice and Sing Park, its current state, which is just, it would look like a vacant grass lot if you drove by it with a few historical markers. I mean, it's an embarrassment. And, you know, of course, that park and the proposed James Weldon Johnson Park in downtown are not mutually exclusive of one another. But yeah, I mean, I think it's indicative of the kind of pattern that we see over and over again in the city, which is that, you know, the council and the mayor certainly know how to take decisive action and get things done when they're interested in something. When they're not, it just kind of languishes. And I think that, you know, watching Lift Every Voice and Sing Park just sort of sit there is a prime example of that. There has been no effort to speed that up. There's no urgency to get it done. There is money in the capital improvement budget in the one of the out years, so it's not real money. It's not anything that's even been committed. It's just a joke, and it's an embarrassment.
And Ann Schindler, what about the tabulations of Johnson's group, takeitdown.org, that because Richmond, Virginia, the capital of the Confederacy, had been known as the place with the most monuments to the Confederacy, but they are in the process of dismantling all those monuments and markers. According to his calculations, Jacksonville now has the most taxpayer-funded monuments or place names or sites of some kind that honor the Confederacy, although that is in the process of being changed. I think that's news to a lot of people. People might not have realized that.
Yeah, I think what's interesting too, Melissa, is that that list doesn't actually accord with the city's list of items, you know, that they want to remove. There's this list of 11 things, markers and such that the city plans to remove. And I've actually tried since the day that that was announced to find out from the city how that list was, you know, created, what the process was to get information or feedback from the Historical Society, for instance, who put up a number of those markers. And these are markers that are not, you know, they don't have the name Confederate in them. But a number of those that you mentioned, the streets and the park and such like that, are not on the list. Mm-hmm. And it's not really clear how they came up with that list. It best I can tell, there's zero public records, you know, for the genesis of where any of that came from. It just sort of popped fully formed out of the planning department, and there's no other record of it. So I think it's kind of interesting to see that they have a list that isn't necessarily addressing some of the historic markers of greatest concern, but is actually removing some that, you know, like the sinking of the maple leaf, which is not necessarily like a hagiography to the Confederacy. It's just a marker stating that this thing happened in this place.
Right. I don't know if the city's list includes, for example, General Lee Road or Confederate Point Road or Yellow Bluff. Those are the some of the what's on the list for takeitdown.org. Now, Mike Mendenhall, at the same time on that list are some school names. And this week, the Duval County School Board said that they are looking at renaming some more schools because of their ties to a shameful past, particularly the treatment of Native Americans. They are looking at renaming Andrew Jackson High, Jean Ribault High, and Jean Ribault Middle School. They'll go through a process for this, of course, but it goes along with the renaming of Hemming Park. It's a process that, a painful process, cities across America are undertaking right now, reckoning with this history and trying to change names that are offensive to great numbers of Americans because they're such painful reminders of oppression and frankly, evil.
Yeah, and I mean, and it's never easy to go through a public process like that, especially when there's still when there still seems to be feelings on both sides. And one thing to note too, it was interesting when this bill for the Hemming Park was going through City Council, when Councilmember Danny Becton recommended to rename it the Veterans Plaza, it kind of took Garrett Dennis, the council member who introduced the bill, by surprise. It was kind of a quick move. And going back to Lift Every Voice and Sing Park. The money in the CIP that Nate mentioned that's kind of out in an out year, there is also some money that was set aside, about $100,000. It was part of a deal with Vestcor, which is developing townhomes in La Villa around that area. So there's also going to be $100,000 in that as part of that deal for a La Villa Heritage Trail, which is supposed to honor the Black heritage in that area, but still that anybody who develops parks knows that $100,000 isn't going to get you all the way there. So there is still a lot of work that needs to be done.
And Fred, what about this? There's a move afoot to rename Beach Boulevard. A petition to rename it John the Baptist Boulevard. This is founded by a waste disposal executive and also local developer Tony Slayman. And they say this has nothing to do with the recent efforts around the country to rename schools and parks that were named after slave owners. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, it is interesting that would come up at this time. That process is going to go through the standard renaming process for the road. I don't know at this point. It's not clear as to whether he's just talking about a section of Beach Boulevard, but I assume he's not talking about the entire Beach Boulevard. And again, there's a constituency that would take exception to that stretch being named after John the Baptist. There is some controversy, obviously, among religious groups that would come up automatically for folks who are not of the Christian persuasion, for instance. So all these things are in the hopper, but that's a long ways down the road, and I would imagine that will have to go through a couple of processes before it even reaches City Council for final approval.
Let's go to your calls. It's our Friday roundtable, 549-2937. Give us a call. Wells on the south side. Wells, you're on the air.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning.
I have a question and a comment. My question is the truth about slavery, Jim Crow, terror lynching has never really been taught in our schools, and I want to ask your listeners and panel why that is. My statement is I'm a member of Take 'Em Down Jacks. We've been struggling for years with the city council and the mayor to have these statues removed and the schools renamed. This ploy by this veterans group is just another example of how the refusal to name anything after Africans or African Americans in this country shows the depth of white supremacy in this city, in this state, and in this country. And we have to understand that until we talk about dismantling institutionalized racism and dealing with white supremacy, we're going to be in this same fix forever. Now we have somebody who wants a group that wants to rename Beach Boulevard. I mean, think about that. Think about the move that's being made to disavow anything that the African American community asked for. 50 years of promises that have not been kept. I want to know when things are going to change. And I don't think they'll change, not until the African American community stands up. Thank you.
Well, all right, Wells, a few things there in his comment, Nate. The first one being that as Americans, we don't know our history. And there has been a massive amount of denial about American history. And the this long overdue reckoning to come to terms with our shameful past is just now beginning to happen through this movement we're witnessing. I want to point out, sure, too, that, but, you know, there are some, James Weldon Johnson's name is on things, in particular a local school. So it's not as though nothing has been named after him in Jacksonville. That said, it is really eye-popping to see that there would be resistance to naming the park, the downtown park, after him. Because as you wrote in your column this week, he is the most famous and most accomplished individual Jacksonville has ever produced in its history. So you can understand why African Americans feel slighted about this process.
Absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, in this city in particular, I mean, the history, I was talking to someone about this yesterday. What strikes me about the way that we tend to talk about history the most, we either focus on like 1901 in the Great Fire, or we jump all the way ahead to like 1968, 1969, when the city and county consolidated. Like, that's City Hall's posture is pretty much always that time began at the consolidation vote. And that skips over a whole lot of history. And a lot of that history, that stuff in the middle between the Great Fire and consolidation, is where a lot of these kind of troubling racial events have taken place, like Axe Handle Saturday. It doesn't seem to me that there's quite the amount of interest in that slice of our history as there is in the time immediately before it and in the time immediately after. And perhaps that's, you know, a bit of a microcosm for, you know, the way that we look at American history generally.
Amira on the West Side. Amira, thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
So my daughter went to Douglas Anderson School of the Arts, and I asked teachers, principals, kids, no one really knew anything about Douglas Anderson. And he was an African-American who actually started busing kids in that actual area, which was predominantly white, and that was only for African-Americans in that district. But no one really knows anything about that. So I don't think there's really a reason to rename the school if we're not going to educate the kids about the African-American or person of color that the school is named after, the way we teach them about Jackson and Lee. And I'll take the answer off there.
Thanks, Amira. You know, Anne, it's simply a fact that all of us grew up going to schools that were named after people that we knew nothing about, whether they were horrible people or not.
And John Hersey High School, you know, the guy who wrote the Hiroshima book, and didn't know who John Hersey was. So, I mean, it's not uncommon for people to attend a high school and not know any of the history that surrounds them. At the same time, Jacksonville, you know, it's only a few years ago that we changed the name of a high school that was named after a Klansman. And that was
the founder of the Klan. Yeah.
And it was a very difficult fight. And there was tons of people that lined up before the school board to defend this guy, Nathan Bedford Forrest, saying that, you know, he deserved to be honored. So moving to, you know, just plain old, you know, Confederate generals from active Klansmen is, only a 7-year jump for Jacksonville. Obviously there's a lot of ugly history to erase yet. And, you know, I think there's more education to be done around the subject. Like the caller says, it's, you know, there's a rich history in this area that we also need to educate better on, including about people like James Weldon Johnson and Douglas Anderson.
Right. And James Weldon Johnson was played a key part in the Harlem Renaissance. He helped found the NAACP, just a slew of accomplishments. at upcoming NFL games, although maybe not this season because they very well may not play given the pandemic. They will now at every upcoming NFL game play Lift Every Voice and Sing, which is well loved as the so-called Black National Anthem. It was composed by Johnson and his brother. And Mike Mendenhall, when we talk about schools, here's a quote from board member Ashley Smith Juarez. We began with renaming six schools named for Confederate officers. We should continue with schools named for people responsible for systematically marginalizing and killing indigenous people. And that's a reference to Jackson and also Rebolt. And so, of course, this town is named after Andrew Jackson, who was responsible for the Trail of Tears and the Native American genocide. So, you know, as we talk about the renaming of schools, people opposed to that idea have said, well, if you're going to do that, when are we going to start talking about the renaming of this city? And there are some voters out there that would like to see that, although I think they're in the minority.
Yeah, and there's still a statue of Andrew Jackson in downtown, quite prominently, you know, right in front of the river. It's that reminder, you know, even if the school does get renamed, that reminder is still going to be there. And you know, I actually went to an elementary school named after Harriet Beecher Stowe, who was the abolitionist and author. Back in the 1800s, and we did have a core, or one of our teachers did have a hold a lesson as to who Harriet Beecher Stowe was, but that, from what I found, that was pretty rare, and until local schools all across the country actually get curriculum that teaches not only their local history, which I think is very important, but also an honest interpretation of it. You know, there's not going to be an understanding from everyone in the public as to why people are so passionate about getting rid of some of these names that just are a constant reminder of everything from slavery to segregation.
And Melissa, I just would toss into your, I mean, I think it's probably, you know, incumbent on us as well as members of the media to do, maybe more reporting than we're doing on the subjects that we're generally ignorant about as a community. I mean, the St. Augustine Record did a look back at its own coverage of the civil rights movement recently, and it was a very kind of candid and hard look at how, very often the reporters were told not to go to certain events or not photograph demonstrations. And, you know, that was kind of a top-down decision by the paper's management at the time. They didn't want the city looking bad. And so while the civil rights movement and the violent act, you know, retaliation that people experienced here was covered on a national level in Life magazine and others, it wasn't covered in the local paper. So, yeah. I mean, there's probably something that we all could do as members of the media to, you know, make people more aware of the city's history and
That's right. We, at WJCT, we have produced a documentary on Axe Handle Saturday that we've aired it multiple times, actually. And your comment, Anne, reminds me of some years ago on this show, we interviewed the late Jessie Lynn Kerr, who was a columnist at the Times Union. And she covered King's appearance in Northeast Florida in the early 1960s. She said on this program before she died that a story she did one weekend integrated the Times Union, because there used to be two papers in this town, one for white people, one for African-American people. And the white paper never put stories about the Black community, especially positive ones, in the white paper. And when Bob Hayes came back from the Olympics with a slew of gold medals and they had a parade in his honor, well, she went to her editor and said, we need to cover this story. And her editor said, no, that goes in the other paper. And she said, well, I don't know anybody else who's in Jacksonville who's come back from the Olympics with a bunch of gold medals. And he finally broke down and agreed to run the story. And that's what broke the color line in the local paper. Bullet Bob Hayes, as he was known, Fred. That's just one anecdote we could share.
I had the pleasure of meeting and interviewing Bob several times just before he passed away, and it was an incredible time. That section of the paper was called For and About Black People. I think it was named The Journal. And you look forward to getting your edition of that every week to give you some contrast to the Florida Star, which was the major African-American paper during that period of time, and of course still exists to this day. But the choosing of these names, the school board has a better process for determining how they're going to change names or not. That was put together when Westside High School, of course, was renamed. The city council is much more political process, as we see right now. It's pretty much going by fiat and who's going to have the loudest voice. I don't know. It doesn't appear that citizens at large are going to have a great deal of input into this process, except for the 3 minutes they get at the podium. But it is quite a slippery.
Yeah, that's a good point. If I could jump in, Nate, what about that? Shouldn't there have been maybe more of a input from the public on this?
I think this is a tricky one because when you're talking about renaming something, I mean, how do you put something like that up to a vote? I mean, at some point, the council has to make a decision about what to put on the ballot. Which names are you going to put on the ballot, you know? Or, I mean, I feel like you can't really get around this problem if you view it that way, that the council is going to have to make a decision about some universe of names that, you know, will be acceptable for the park. And that's somewhat, you know, some voters might be displeased about that one way or another. I mean, this is not selling JEA. This is not passing a city budget. This is not implementing a tax increase. This is renaming a park. This should be an easy decision for them to make. I mean, we elect these representatives to do this kind of thing.
Right.
And the fact that they can't, I just find to be, you know, really bizarre. You know, the decision that was facing the council on Monday and that will face them again is whether to rename the park James Weldon Johnson Park. It's not that name versus naming it for veterans any more than it's that name versus naming it for like puppies or rainbows or ice cream or any other inoffensive thing that people can think of. Like, name the park after him or don't. But setting it up as this, as if they're choosing between one or the other, is just artificial. I mean, it is a contrived way to make the decision seem like something it's not.
Lots of emails. Meanwhile, here's one. For those that want to rename Beach Boulevard as John the Baptist Boulevard, just take JTB, goes to the same place and runs parallel. Hey, you wouldn't have to change any signs. All right, here's an email from Ed on Jean Ribault. How can you attack a French explorer who established a settlement in Jacksonville in 1562? He was at the mercy of the Timucuan controlling the area and was wiped out by the Spanish a few years later. Okay, one more call on this, and then we're going to move on and talk about the upcoming academic year. Jessica is downtown. Hi, Jessica. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to say, like your previous caller, I also went to Douglas Anderson, and I found, too, that none of the other students my age knew who he was. Wikipedia was just becoming a thing, so mm-hmm. I happened to, you know, look it up since I'd gone there, and I was pleased to find out that history. But also there, we had a great AP U.S. history teacher who taught us from the book Lies My Teacher Told Me Everything Your American History Teacher Got Wrong, and I would encourage parents of high schoolers especially to get involved and ask questions about your child's curriculum if you're concerned that they're not getting this history in their school. Sometimes you might be pleasantly surprised, and other times you might be able to make suggestions and you'd be surprised at how open administration is taking those. Also, I just have a simple fix for Jacksonville. We just need to rename the whole city Johnsonville for Mr. James Weldon Johnson. The alliteration with the Jaguars would still work. And we can take down this man Jackson statue and replace it with the Beach Boulevard dinosaur, and I think it would have a lot more goodwill. I'll take my answers off the air.
Oh, my gosh. You know, the kids are all right. The kids are all right. Thank you, Jessica. Speaking of kids, it's our Friday Media Roundtable, and give us a call at 549-2937 because Florida schools are set to begin their academic year in a couple of weeks, despite growing concern from students, parents, and teachers. The governor and the mayor are also pushing for school sports to start back up again. Here's DeSantis yesterday in Jacksonville.
I think that these athletes will probably be amongst the very, very top to be able to fight off the virus. And so we should just understand that, understand what the actual risks are.
Okay, give us a call. Let us know how you feel about class and sports starting up again. It's 549-2937. Ann Schindler DeSantis made these remarks as the teachers union in this state has filed a lawsuit over a five-day-a-week brick-and-mortar school. Teachers are afraid that they're going to contract the virus.
Yeah, and it's interesting how the local school board is trying to take that issue on by offering, you know, health coverage and health care for teachers on every aspect of COVID, from rapid testing to, care and treatment. And, you know, they're anticipating this concern because so many teachers have expressed fears about their own health returning to school. And it's a difficult challenge. I mean, right now, what I've seen from these school districts is they're asking, you know, basically if kids contract the virus or have an exposure that they self-quarantine, kind of like we do, but there's no mechanism to check whether they've been tested or whether they've been cleared for return. It's kind of an honor system. And I think, you know, anybody that's ever dealt with a daycare knows the parents who drop off their kid with a snotty nose knows that there's not always 100% transparency in terms of, you know, how parents who need to get their kids to school are, you know, disclosing whether or not they may or may not have been exposed to the virus. There's a lot of healthcare risks. And the teachers, you know, a lot of them are in health predicaments, you know, with some sort of underlying health issue. They can't fare well with an exposure.
And about the sports aspect, Mike, here's an email from a listener. I was watching the news last night and I noticed during local high school sports scenes around town, kids and coaches were not wearing masks. During a segment at a local YMCA, only one person had a mask on incorrectly and others milled around. Some had masks on, some didn't. I'm afraid our local COVID numbers could explode because coaches and other adults are being so cavalier. And so we have the governor and the mayor saying, look, the kids need sports. At the same time, if precautions aren't being followed, it's reasonable to expect it will cause a spike in COVID numbers.
Yeah, and I mean, and the inherent nature of sports requires close contact, and you know, and so you're going to have an increased rate or increased possibility of transmission. You know, it's interesting, and during that news conference or that roundtable yesterday, Governor DeSantis said that he wanted local schools and sports teams to kind of follow the European model if a player tests positive, to isolate, to test, do temperature checks. One of the things, though, that's different between the United States and Europe right now is their daily cases per capita are much lower than the United States. So many European countries have done a better job than the U.S. actually containing the virus. So the lower prevalence, you know, allows for less risk of transmission. And you know, and it's not lost on anybody that, you know, that it's unfortunate that students, especially seniors who, you know, have worked a long time, aren't going to be able to, or may not be able to, you know, have a full senior football season. I mean, that's an opportunity that, you know, a lot of us, you know, had growing up as kids, and it is character building. It does reduce possibility of crime and poor behavior and teaches character. But, you know, there's also that safety aspect, not only for the students, but for their families and anyone they're exposed to.
Lisa on the South Side. Go ahead, Lisa.
Oh,
hi,
yes,
Lisa.
Hi. Thank you, Melissa. I find it very just ignorant that people think that just because kids are playing sports that they can't catch this COVID. I mean, for crying out loud, we have baseball teams and already some of the team members caught COVID-19, and they're restricting them. There's no one in the stadium. So the fact that this governor once again is talking about how kids can't catch anything really shows once again how he is really not equipped to be our governor, and he needs to step down because he's just at risk at putting our kids in jeopardy for money, because that's all this is. It's about money. It's not about kids, and it's not about the well-being.
Why do you think it, whose money, Leah?
Well, think about all the high schoolers who play football and the baseball teams. I mean, it's really revenue that supposedly is going to the state or the schools, but really it's all about sponsorship and advertising. It's not about the kids, because if it was, then there would be more money and more help towards the teachers and the school systems that can actually try to open up safely.
All right, Leah. Yeah, thank you, Leah. Yeah. Nate, what about the fact that the governor, who has taken a lot of criticism for taking his cues from the president on these protocols, is saying that it's okay to open up sports and classrooms? Both Facebook and Twitter have temporarily disabled the president from posting on those platforms because he spread misinformation about coronavirus this week, saying that kids virtually cannot catch it, which is simply not true.
It's not true. I mean, you know, the caller suggested that DeSantis step down. I mean, I think the reality is that DeSantis is essentially abdicated parts of his job to appointed officials anyway. You know, it was the his education commissioner that required schools to open and required this, you know, this notion of giving parents choice. And I mean, I get the sense that, you know, the leaders in this state have simply kind of given up on their jobs generally. Like, they're tired of dealing with COVID. They are tired of making these kind of tough incremental decisions about how to handle mitigation for spreading the virus. And they have just decided to just open it up and give people the choice. Like, if you want to send your kid to school, go. And of course that overlooks the fact that obviously people who work at those schools won't have a choice. But yeah, I mean, I think they've just kind of given up. Like, they're just tired of making decisions, and this is a reflection of that.
Ann Schindler, you know, a Duval County School Board member told me anonymously that they wouldn't be surprised if Duval does go back to all virtual school and junks the hybrid plan. Hillsborough County over in Tampa has already announced this week that that is what they are going to do. That's what South Florida is already doing. This hybrid plan that Duval is looking at could still, even though I agree with Nate's point that across the state people are throwing up their hands and giving up, we still could see a change in the school planning here. If educators believe that, administrators, I should say, believe that despite the mandate from the state to open up the schools, they are just going to see too many COVID cases among their teachers, staff, and students.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're seeing that already, signs from places in South Florida school districts that are just basically saying that's not something you're going to be able to abide by. It's going to be litigated whether the state can actually force their hand. The school districts, I think, are probably, some of them are just going to simply go rogue. I mean, they're going to have to do what they think is best for their local communities. And the idea that there's sort of this arbitrary mandate that is across the board, with the understanding that school districts are different, the infection rate is different in different parts of the state and the country, and there really needs to be some local control. That's why we have a school board that's locally elected. I mean, that's, you know, the idea is that we elect those people to decide what is best for our children and our teachers.
I'm going to take one more call on this. It's Christina in Jacksonville. Christina, good morning.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
So I believe that the schools offered a hybrid plan, and that the people that are still complaining, they have a hybrid plan. Like, I don't understand. Like, and the thing is, so what I just heard the lady saying, if they go to school, it's going to be, you know, chaos. So it's like, well, what's your end goal? So is your end goal waiting to get vaccinated? Like, and so if that's your end goal, which I'm not going to do, you know, been just...
Well, there's no vaccine available anyway. Yet.
Well, I know there's not. Well, I know there's not. They're doing all the trials now. But the thing is this, is like, what's your end goal? You know, and to me, their end goal is to try to get everyone vaccinated, you know, for the virus.
Well, we'll have to see, Christina. I want to thank you for that. And here is an email from Caleb. I'm concerned about COVID making its way to vulnerable student populations, such as ESE students, who frequently are also in high-risk categories. A valid concern, Caleb. Before we go to break, I want to make note of the fact that early voting is underway now for the August 18th Florida primary election. And they are taking precautions at early voting sites, such as plexiglass and only letting a certain number of people in to vote at a time. You can check out a complete election site at wjct.org/elections. Speaking of which, President Trump praised Florida's vote-by-mail system earlier this week after previously saying voters should not trust vote-by-mail. Fred Matthews, as we go to break, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, I guess the president has decided that he can have it both ways. It's safe for him to vote by mail in Florida, but it's not safe for folks who are in the Democrat-led states to vote by mail because they might not vote for him. Look, the process is going to happen, vote by mail. Many of us have had it. I got my notice from the Supervisor of Elections office this week. So it's going to move forward with that. I don't think there's going to be any major changes. The one thing to watch out, however, is, of course, the post office is going to be under increasing pressure, although the Postmaster of the United States basically gave another assurance this week that they're able to handle the load when it comes their way.
That is something to watch. I want to thank all of you so much for being with us, Nate Monroe, Ann Schindler, Fred Matthews, and Mike Mendenhall, all appearing on this program from a slight distance as we continue to work our way through this time. And thanks, guys. Have a great weekend. I really appreciate you being with us.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thanks, everybody. Thank you. A quick break, and up next, it's National Farmers Market Week. We'll check in on Florida's oldest farmers market right here in Jacksonville so you can learn why it's worth celebrating. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
ServPro of Jacksonville South and Arlington Jacksonville East remind you that water damage happens fast. It's important to assemble a disaster supply kit. ServPro of Jacksonville South and Arlington Jacksonville East at servprojacksonvillesouth.com, like it never even happened.
Congaree and Penn, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering picnic meals in a safe, dog-friendly farm setting where social distancing is top priority. Visit congareeandpen.com for more information.
The Terrell Hogan Law Firm. Is your business suffering because of coronavirus? Your insurance policy may already provide coverage. Not sure how to tell? Learn more at terrellhogan.com.
This message is brought to you by the Florida Division of Emergency Management, Florida Public Media, and this radio station.
This is Craig Fugate, the former director of Florida Emergency Management. In this time of COVID, you need to update your hurricane preparedness plan.
That means knowing what evacuation zone you live in, and if ordered to leave, you need to go. Take your pets and stay with family or friends, or at an inland hotel. Shelters are another option. Know your zone, know your home. For more information, go to floridastorms.org. That's floridastorms.org.
The uncertain fate of TikTok in the U.S. has some users anxious. But for most, even those who make money on the platform, it's business as usual.
So back in October, I got fired from Best Buy for making TikTok videos. 2 weeks later, I hit 1 million followers. And now I'm still making videos, but
creating TikToks when there soon might not be a TikTok. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Starting at 4 here on WJCT News 89.9.
As millions look to Congress for a new deal, Mitch McConnell looks to members of his own party.
Yeah, it's a problem. I mean, there are about 20 of my members who think we've already done enough.
Facebook and Twitter suspend the president's campaign account for going too far, and Chief Justice Roberts comes under fire for not going far enough. I'm Jen White. It's the Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, it's National Farmers Market Week, a time to celebrate those amazing markets that bring so much to a city, including this one. Greg Tyson is market manager for Jacksonville Farmers Market, the oldest farmers market in the state and the best. And he's on the line now. Hey, Greg, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having us on.
I can't wait to hear what's going on at Jack's Farmers Market. But first, tell us a little bit about National Farmers Market Week.
Well, the National Farmers Market Week is just an opportunity to highlight the farmers markets around the country and the work that that our agricultural folks are doing around this country to provide food for our citizens and for the world. If it weren't for our farmers and our small farmers doing what they do, we wouldn't have much food on the shelf to choose from. We live in a country that is blessed with the availability of farmers and just what they do to provide for our needs.
That's right. And especially right now in this pandemic, I think that it's a better time than ever to visit a farmer's market. Amazing, healthy produce to boost our immunity, amazing prices, and you're shopping outside, which is safer.
I'm sorry. That's correct. We have actually seen an uptick in traffic since this pandemic started in 3 or 4 months ago, particularly on the weekends. And people are just feeling more secure shopping outside in the open air. And, you know, the selections of fruits and vegetables that we have, you know, we're seeing that uptick. We're keeping a lot of that business coming in. We're still seeing a lot of new faces come into our market on a weekly basis. And, you know, traffic's been good for us.
And I assume you're using the Fresh Access Bucks program for people on SNAP so that they can have even easier access to produce?
We do have a SNAP program. Some selected vendors do use that. As far as some of the Access Bucks, we are not on that program yet here. We are in talks with the folks at B to get that program into our market. But we do have some EBT certified vendors here for SNAP.
Now let's talk a little bit about the incredible longevity and success of your site, the Jacksonville Farmers Market. It is the oldest still operating outdoor farmers market in Florida, first launched in 1938. They've got produce, herbs, local favorites like our famous Mayport shrimp, crafts by local artisans, and there's also a restaurant, the Andy's Farmers Market Grill, just minutes away from downtown. They are located on Beaver Street, 1810 West Beaver. And so,
well, that's correct.
Yeah, go ahead.
That's correct. We, you know, in addition to the fruits and vegetable farmers and vendors that we have, as you mentioned, we have a plant nursery. We have a restaurant, which is now called Bloom's Grill, a change from Andy's this year,
okay.
A new owner. And we have the fresh seafood shop for shrimps and fish and what have you. We have vendors out here selling baked goods, homemade soaps, some of the things you mentioned. And also on the weekends, we have a farmer that comes in and sells live chickens and poultry that folks come in and buy and, you know, to take home.
Oh, I didn't realize that. So it's no surprise that there's been an uptick in business. And why do you think you guys have the longevity you have? Because certainly there are a lot of great farmers markets around, but yours is the oldest in Florida.
Well, I think one thing that drives folks out here is we're the oldest in Florida. We get phone calls from all over the Southeast. Folks wanting to know if we're still open. People driving in from as far away as Savannah, Georgia on a Saturday, West Florida, Central Florida to come up, Daytona area. We have folks like that coming in all the time. And we've been around since 1938. We've got pictures that we use in some of our material showing the old horse-drawn buggies coming into the market, bringing produce in. The market now sits on almost 10 acres next door to where it used to be from that 1938 date. But there are still a lot of folks in the Jacksonville area who remember that old market, and they come out. As a matter of fact, I had a call this week from a lady. She says, I haven't been out there in so many years. And she was remembering a place called Sandy Steerhouse, which was a steakhouse on the old market. She was asking me about that, and she did not realize that we had moved just next door onto another facility. So, there are still folks out there that remember the old market. I grew up on that market with my grandparents coming out to shop, watching the trains, pull in there by the market and what have you. And it's just a lot of nostalgic atmosphere to it.
Absolutely. But always keeping pace with current trends. So I really I really do encourage everyone to head on out there maybe this weekend to the Jacksonville Farmers Market. They're on Beaver Street, just west of downtown. Open every day from 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. It is National Farmers Market Week. You will not find a better deal on incredible produce and a really good variety anywhere around. We're out of time, Greg. Go ahead quickly.
I was going to say we have retail and wholesale operations out here, so you can shop either one of them.
Excellent. Greg, thank you so much. He's Greg Tyson, Market Manager for Jack's Farmers Market. JacksFarmersMarket.com, the oldest farmers market in Florida. See you soon, Greg.
Thank you very much.
Happy shopping, everybody, and thanks for listening. Make sure to tune in today at noon for the Florida Roundup. We'll round up the biggest news across the state. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect. Have a great weekend. We'll be back at 9 a.m. Monday.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.